Chapter 30. Crozier. Latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. 15 February 1848.
Gentlemen, it is time we looked at our possible courses of action in the coming months, said Captain Crozier. I have decisions to make.
The officers and some warrant officers and other specialists, such as the two civilian engineers, four top captains and ice masters, as well as the last surviving surgeon, had been called to this meeting in Terror's great cabin. Terror had been chosen by Crozier, not to inconvenience Captain Fitzjames and his officers, who had to make the crossing during the brief hour of sunlight and hoped to be back before it grew dark again, nor to emphasize the change of flagship, but only because fewer men on Crozier's ship were confined to sickbay. It had been easier to move those few to a temporary sickbay in the bow to free up the great cabin for the meeting of officers. Erebus had twice the number of men down with symptoms of scurvy, and Dr. Goodsir had indicated that a few of them were too sick to be moved. Now 15 of the expedition's leaders were crowded around the long table that in January had been cut into shorter lengths to serve as operating tables for the surgeon, but now was set to rights by Mr. Honey, Terror's carpenter. The officers and civilians had left their rainproof slops, mittens, Welsh wigs and comforters at the base of the main ladder, but they still wore all their other layers. The room smelled of wet wool and unwashed bodies. The long cabin was cold, and no light came through the Prestant patent illuminators overhead, since the deck remained under 3 feet of snow and its winter canvas cover. The whale oil lamps on the bulkheads flickered dutifully, but did little to dispel the gloom. The gathering at the table resembled a gloomier version of the summer war council Sir John Franklin had called almost 18 months earlier on Erebus. But now, instead of Sir John at the head of the table on the starboard side, Francis Crozier sat there. On the aft side of the table to Crozier's left were the 7 officers and warrant officers from Terror whom he had asked to be present. His executive officer, First Lieutenant Edward Little, was at Crozier's immediate left. Next was Second Lieutenant George Hodgson, with Third Lieutenant John Irving to his left. Then the civilian engineer, given warrant officer status on the expedition, but looking thinner, paler, and more cadaverous than ever, James Thompson. On Thompson's left were Ice Master Thomas Blanky, who appeared to be stumping along very nicely on his wooden peg leg these days, and Captain of the Foretop, Harry Pegler, the only petty officer Crozier had invited. Also present was Terror's Sergeant Tozer, who had been out of both captains' graces since the night of the Carnival, when his men had fired on survivors of the fire, but who was still the highest-ranked survivor of his heavily thinned group of lobsterbacks, speaking for the Marines. At the port end of the long table sat Captain Fitzjames. Crozier knew that Fitzjames had not bothered to shave for several weeks, growing a reddish beard surprisingly flecked with grey. But he had made the effort today, or had ordered Mr. Hoare, his steward, to shave him. The effect only made his face look thinner and more pale, and now it was covered with countless small scrapes and cuts. Even with multiple layers of clothes on, it was obvious that Fitzjames's garments hung on a much frailer frame these days. To Captain Fitzjames's left, along the forward side of the long table, sat 6 Erebuses. Immediately to his left was his only other surviving naval officer, Sir John Franklin. First Lieutenant Gore and Lieutenant James Walter Fairholme had all been killed by the thing on the ice. Lieutenant H.T.D. Le Vicomte, the man's gold tooth gleaming the few times he smiled. Next to Le Vicomte was Charles Frederick Devaux, who had taken over the duties of first mate from Robert Orme Sargent, who had been killed by the thing while overseeing torch cairn repair in December. Next to Devaux sat the only surviving surgeon, Dr. Harry D.S. Goodsir. While technically the expedition's and Crozier's surgeon now, both the commanding officers and the surgeon had thought it appropriate for him to sit with his former Erebus crewmates. To good sir's left sat Ice Master James Reed, and to his left the only Erebus petty officer present, Captain of the Foretop, Robert Sinclair. And sitting on the forward side of the table was Erebus's engineer, John Gregory, looking much healthier than his Terror counterpart. Tea and weevil-rich biscuits were being served by Mr. Gibson of Terror and Mr. Bridgins of Erebus, since the captain's stewards were both in sickbay with signs of scurvy.
"Let's discuss things in order," said Crozier. "First, can we stay in the ships until a possible summer thaw? And part of that answer has to be, can the ships sail in June or July or August if there is a thaw? Captain FitzJames?"
FitzJames's voice was a hollow husk of its once confident firmness. Men on both sides of the table leaned closer to hear him.
"I don't think Erebus will last until summer. And it's my opinion, and the opinion of Mr. Weeks and Mr. Watson, my carpenters, and Mr. Brown, my boatswain's mate, Mr. Wigdon, my coxswain, and of Lieutenant Leveconte and First Mate DeVoe here, that she will think when the ice melts."
The cold air in the great cabin seemed to grow colder and to press more heavily on everyone. No one spoke for half a minute.
"The pressure from the ice these past 2 winters has squeezed the oakum right out from between the hull boards," continued FitzJames in his small, hoarse voice. "The main shaft to the screw has been twisted beyond all repair. All of you know that it was designed to be retracted into an iron well all the way up to the orlop deck, to be kept out of harm's way. But it will no longer retract any higher than the hull bottom, and we have no more replacement shafts. The screw itself has been shattered by the ice, as has been our rudder. We can jury-rig another rudder, but the ice has torn our hull bottom to splinters all along the length of the keel. We're missing almost half of our iron plating along the bow and sides. Worse,"
said FitzJames,
"the ice has squeezed the hull until the iron crossbeams, added for reinforcement, and the cast iron replacements for her knees, have either snapped or punctured the hull in more than a dozen places. If she were to float, even if we patched every breach and managed somehow to repair the problem with the screw shaft well leaking, she would have no internal bracing against the ice. Also, while the wooden channels added to her side for this expedition have largely succeeded in keeping the ice from climbing over the raised gunwales, the downward pressure on these channels resulting from her raised position in the encroaching ice has caused splitting of the hull timbers along every channel seam."
FitzJames seemed to notice their rapt attention for the first time. His unfocused stare went away, and he looked down as if embarrassed. When he looked up again, his voice sounded almost apologetic.
"Worst of all," he said, "is that the twisting pressure of the ice has so corkscrewed the sternpost and started the heads and ends of planking that Erebus has been bent far out of true by the stress. The decks break upward now. The only thing holding them in place is the weight of the snow, and none of us believe that our pumps could equal the leaks should she be floated again. I will let Mr. Gregory speak to the condition of the boiler, coal supplies, and propulsion system."
All eyes shifted to John Gregory. The engineer cleared his throat and licked his chapped and bleeding lips.
"There is no steam propulsion system left on HMS Erebus," he said. "With the main shaft twisted and jammed in the retraction well, we'd need a Bristol dry dock to set her right. Nor do we have enough coal left for a day's steaming. By the end of April, we'll be out of coal to heat the ship, even at the rate of moving just 45 minutes of hot water a day, only to parts of the lower deck that we're trying to keep habitable now.
Crozier said,
Mr. Thompson, what is Terror's status in terms of steam?
The living skeleton looked at his captain for a long minute and said in a voice that was surprisingly strong,
We wouldn't be able to steam for more than an hour or two, sir, if Terror was floated this afternoon. Our shaft was retracted all right a year and a half ago, and the screw is workable, and we have a replacement for that. But we're almost out of coal. If we were to transfer what's left of Erebus's coal stores here and just heat the ship, we'd keep the boiler going and the hot water running 2 hours a day until, I'd venture early May. But that wouldn't leave any coal for steaming. With just Terror stores of fuel, we'll have to stop eating by mid or late April.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson, said Crozier. The captain's voice was soft and betrayed no emotion. Lieutenant Little and Mr. Pegler, would both of you be so kind as to give your assessment of the Terror's seaworthiness?
Little nodded and looked down the table before returning his gaze to his captain.
We're not as knocked up as Erebus, but there's been ice pressure damage to the hull, knees, outer plating, rudder and inner bracings.
Some of you know that before Christmas, Lieutenant Irving discovered not only that we had lost most of our iron plating along the starboard side back from the bow, but that 10 inches of oak and elm in the bow area had actually sprung the timbers in the forward cable locker on the hull deck. And we've found since that the 13 inches of solid oak along her bottom have been sprung or compromised in 20 or 30 places. The bow boards have been replaced and reinforced, but we can't get to all her bottom because of the frozen slush down there.
I think she'll float and steer, Captain, concluded Lieutenant Little. But I can't promise that the pumps will be able to keep up with the leaks, especially after the ice has another 4 or 5 months to work at her. Mr. Pegler can speak to that better than I can.
Harry Pegler cleared his throat. He obviously wasn't used to speaking in front of so many officers.
If she'll float, sirs, then the foretop crew will get the masts reset and the rigging, shrouds and canvas up within 48 hours of the time you give the word. I can't guarantee that sailing will get us through the thick ice of the sort we saw coming south, but if we have open water under us and ahead of us, we'll be a sailing ship again. And if you don't mind me making a recommendation, sirs, I'd suggest we steep the masts sooner rather than later.
You're not worried about ice building up and capsizing the ship, asked Crozier, or ice falling on us when we're working on deck. We have months of blizzards ahead of us still, Harry.
Aye, sir, said Pegler, and capsizing's always a worry. Even if we were just to tumble over the ice here, the ship being all cattywampus the way she is, but I still think it'd be better to have the topmasts up and the rigging in place in case there's a sudden thaw. We might have to sail with 10 minutes warning. And the topmen need the exercise and work, sir. As for the ice falling, well, it'll just be another thing to keep us alert and on our toes out there. That and the beastie on the ice.
Several men around the table chuckled. Little's and Pegler's mostly positive reports had helped ease some of the tension. The thought of even one of the two ships being able to float and sail raised morale. It felt to Crozier as if the temperature in the great cabin had actually risen. And perhaps it had, since many of the men seemed to be exhaling again.
Thank you, Mr. Pegler, said Crozier. It looks like if we want to sail out of here, we'll all have to do it, both crews, aboard Terror.
None of the surviving officers present mentioned that this had been precisely what Crozier had suggested doing almost 18 months earlier.
Every officer present appeared to be thinking it. Let's take a minute to talk about that thing on the ice, said Crozier. It hasn't seemed to have made an appearance recently.
I've not had to treat anyone for wounds since the 1st of January, said Dr. Goodsir, and no one has died or disappeared since Carnival.
But there have been sightings, said Lieutenant Le Vicomte.
something large moving among the seracs, and men on watch hear things in the dark.
Men on watch at sea have always heard things in the dark, said Lieutenant Little, going back to the Greeks.
Perhaps it has gone away, said Lieutenant Irving. Migrated, moved south or north.
Everyone fell silent again at this thought.
Perhaps it's eaten enough of us to know we're not very tasty, said Ice Master Blanky.
Some of the men smiled at this. No one else could have said it and been excused the gallows humor, but Mr. Blanky, with his peg leg, had earned some prerogatives.
My marines have been searching, as per Captain Crozier's and Captain Fitzjames's orders, said Sergeant Tozer. We've shot at a few bears, but none of them seem to be the big one, the thing.
Are your pure men have been better shots than they were on the night of the carnival, said Sinclair,
Erebus's foretop captain. Tozer turned to his right and squinted down the table at him.
There'll be no more of that, said Crozier. For the time being, we'll have to assume that the thing on the ice is still alive and will be back. Any activities we have to do off the ships will have to include some plan of defense against it. We don't have enough marines to accompany every possible sledge party, especially if they're armed and not man-hauling. So perhaps the answer is to arm all ice parties and have the extra men, the ones not hauling, take turns serving as sentries and guards. Even if the ice doesn't open again this summer, it will be easier to travel in the constant daylight.
You'll pardon me phrasing it this bluntly, Captain, said Dr. Goodsir. But the real question is, can we afford to wait until summer before deciding whether to abandon the ships?
Can we, Doctor? Asked Crozier.
I do not believe so, said the surgeon. More of the canned food is contaminated or putrefied than we had thought. We're running low on all other stores. The men's diet is already below what they need for the work they're doing every day on the ship or out on the ice. Everyone is losing weight and energy. Add to that the sudden rise in scurvy cases and... Well, gentlemen, I simply do not believe that many of us on Erebus or Terra, if the ships themselves last that long, will have the energy or concentration abilities to make any sledge trip if we wait until June or July to see if the ice breaks up.
The room was silent again. Into the silence, good sir added,
Or rather, a few men may well have the energy to haul sledges and boats in a bid for rescue or to reach civilization, but they will have to leave the vast majority of others behind to starve.
The strong could go for help to bring rescue parties back to the ships, said Lieutenant Le Vicomte.
It was Ice Master Thomas Blanky who spoke up.
Anyone heading south, say by hauling our boat south to the mouth of the Great Fish River, and then upstream 850 miles farther south to Great Slave Lake, where there's an outpost, wouldn't get there until late autumn or winter at the best, and couldn't return with an overland rescue party until late summer of 1849. Everyone left behind on the ships would be dead of scurvy and starvation by then.
We could load sledges and all head east to Baffin Bay, said First Mate Devoe. There might be whalers there, or even rescue ships and sledge parties already searching for us.
Aye, said Blanky, that's a possibility. But we'd have to man-haul sledges across hundreds of miles of open ice, what with all its pressure ridges and maybe open leads, or follow the coast, and that would be more than 1,200 miles. And then we'd have to cross the whole Boothia Peninsula, with all its mountains and obstacles, to get to the east coast, where the whalers might be. We could haul the boats with us to cross leads, but that would triple our effort. One thing is sure, if the ice ain't opening here, it won't be open if we head northeast toward Baffin Bay.
There would be far less weight if we only take sledges with provisions and tents to the northeast across Boothia, said Lieutenant Hodgson from the Terror side of the table. One of the pinnaces must weigh at least 600 pounds.
More like 800 pounds, Captain Crozier said softly.
without stores in it.
Add to that more than 600 pounds for a sledge that could carry a boat, said Thomas Blanky, and we'd be man-hauling between 14 and 1500 pounds for each party. Just the weight of the boat and sledge. Not counting food, tents, weapons, clothes, and other things we'd have to haul with us. No one has ever man-hauled that much weight for more than 1,000 miles. And much of it would be across open sea ice if we head for Baffin Bay.
But a sledge with runners on the ice, and possibly a sail, especially if we leave in March or April before the ice gets runny and sticky, would be easier going than man-hauling gear over land or through summer slush, said Lieutenant Le Vicomte.
I say we leave the boats behind and travel light to Baffin Bay with just sledges and survival stores, said Charles Devaux. If we arrive on the east coast of Somerset Island to the north before the whaling season ends, we're bound to be picked up by a ship, and I would wager that there will be Navy rescue ships and sledge parties there looking for us.
If we leave the boats behind, said Ice Master Blanky, one open stretch of water will stop us for good. We die out there on the ice.
Why would rescuers be on the east side of Somerset Island and the Boothia Peninsula in the first place? Asked Lieutenant Little. If they're searching for us, won't they follow our path through Lancaster Sound to Devon and Beachy and Cornwallis Islands? They know Sir John's sailing orders. They will presume we made it through Lancaster Sound, since it's open most summers. There's no chance at all of any of us making it that far north. Perhaps the ice is as bad up at Lancaster Sound this year as it is down here, said Ice Master Reed. That would keep the search parties farther south, out on the east side of Somerset Island, and the Boothia.
Maybe they'll find the messages what we left in the cairns way up at Beachy if they do get through, said Sergeant Tozer. And send sledges or ships south the way we come.
Silence descended like a shroud.
There were no messages left at Beachy, Captain Fitzjames said into that silence.
In the embarrassed vacuum that followed this statement, Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier found a strange, hot, pure flame burning in his chest. It was a sensation rather like a first sip of whiskey after days without it, but also nothing at all like that. Crozier wanted to live. It was that simple. He was determined to live. He was going to survive this bad patch in the face of all odds and gods dictating that he would not and could not. This fire in his chest had been there, even in the shaky, sick hours and painful days after he had emerged from the pit of his malaria and withdrawal brush with death in early January. The flame grew stronger every day. Perhaps more than any other man around the long table in the great cabin this day, Francis Crozier understood the near impossibility of the courses of action being discussed. It was folly to head south across the ice toward Great Fish River. Folly to head for Somerset Island, across 1,200 miles of coastal ice, pressure ridges, open leads, and an unknown peninsula. Folly to think that the ice would open up this summer and allow Terror, overcrowded with two crews and almost empty of provisions, to sail out of the hopeless trap that Sir John had led them into. Nonetheless, Francis Crozier was determined to live. The flame burned in him like strong Irish whiskey.
Have we given up on the idea of sailing out? Robert Sinclair was saying.
James Reed, Erebus's ice master, answered. We would have to sail almost 300 miles north up the unnamed strait and sound that Sir John discovered, then through Barrow Strait and Lancaster Sound, then get south through Baffin Bay before the ice closed on us again. We had the steam engine and armour plating to help us bash through the ice heading south.
even if the ice relents to levels it was 2 summers ago, we would have great difficulty traversing that distance just with sail, and with our weakened wooden hull.
The ice may be considerably less than in 1846,
said Sinclair.
Angels may fly out my arse, said Thomas Blanky.
Because of his missing leg, none of the officers at the table reprimanded the ice master.
A few smiled.
There might be another option, for sailing, I mean, said Lieutenant Edward Little.
Eyes turned in his direction. Enough men had saved some rations of tobacco, stretched out by adding unspeakable things to it, that half a dozen were now smoking pipes around the table. The smoke haze made the gloom even thicker in the dim flicker of the whale oil lamps.
Lieutenant Gore last summer thought that if he spied land to the south of King William Land, continued Little, if he did, that has to be the Adelaide Peninsula, known territory, which quite often has a channel of open water between the coast ice and the pack ice. If enough leads open to allow Terror to sail south, just a little over 100 miles, perhaps rather than the 300 miles back through Lancaster Sound, we could follow open channels along the coast west until we reach the Bering Strait. Everything beyond here would be known territory.
The Northwest Passage, said Third Lieutenant John Irving. The words sounded like a mournful incantation.
But would we have enough able-bodied men to crew the ship by late summer?
Asked Dr. Goodsir, his voice very soft.
By May, the scurvy may have us all in its grip. And what would we do for food during the weeks or months of our passage west?
Hunting might be good farther west, said Marine Sergeant Tozer. Musk oxen, them big deer, walruses, white foxes. Maybe we'd be eating like pashas before we got to Alaska.
Crozier half expected Ice Master Thomas Blanky to say,
and musk oxen might fly out my arse.
But the sometimes giddy Ice Master seemed to be lost in his own reveries. Lieutenant Little answered instead.
Sergeant, our problem is that even if the game were to miraculously return after 2 summers' absence, none of us aboard seems able to hit anything with muskets. Your men excluded, of course. We'd need more than your few surviving marines to hunt, and it appears that none of us has any experience hunting anything much larger than birds. Will the shotguns bring down the game you're talking about?
If you get close enough,
Tozer said sullenly. Crozier interrupted this line of discussion.
Dr. Goodsir made an excellent point earlier. If we wait until midsummer, or perhaps even until June to see if the pack ice breaks up, we may be too ill and hungry to crew the ship. We'd certainly be too low on provisions to start a sledge trip, and we have to assume 3 or 4 months of travel across the ice or up Fish River. So, if we're going to abandon the ships and take to the ice with the hopes of arriving at either Great Slave Lake or the east coast of Somerset Island or Boothia before winter sets in again, our departure obviously has to be before June. But how early?
There was another thick bout of silence.
I would suggest no later than the 1st of May, Lieutenant Little said at last. Earlier, I would think, said Dr. Goodsir, unless we find sources of fresh meat soon, and if the illness continues to spread as quickly as it currently is.
How much earlier? Asked Captain FitzJames.
No later than mid-April,
Goodsir said hesitantly. The men looked at one another through the tobacco smoke and cold air. That was less than 2 months away.
Perhaps, said the surgeon,
his voice sounding both firm and tentative to Crozier,
if conditions continue to worsen.
How could they get worse?
Asked Second Lieutenant Hodgson. The young man obviously had meant it as a joke to lessen the tension.
but was rewarded with baleful and angry stares. Crozier did not want the Council of War to end on that note. The officers, warrant officers, petty officers, and civilian at the table had looked at their choices and seen that they were as bleak as Crozier had known they would be. But he did not want his ship's leader's morale to get any lower than it already was. "By the way," Crozier said in a conversational tone, "Captain FitzJames has decided to conduct divine service next Sunday on Erebus. He'll be giving a special sermon that I'm interested in hearing, although I have it on good authority that it will not be a reading from the Book of Leviathan, and I thought that since the ship's companies will be assembled anyway, we should have full rations of grog and dinner that one day." The men smiled and bantered. None of them had expected to bring back good news to their specialized portions of the crews from this meeting. FitzJames raised one eyebrow very slightly. His special sermon and this divine service 5 days away, Crozier knew, were news to him. But Crozier thought it would probably do the thinning captain good to be preoccupied with something and to be the center of attention for a change. FitzJames nodded ever so slightly.
"Very well then, gentlemen," Crozier said a bit more formally. "This exchange of thoughts and information has been very helpful. Captain FitzJames and I will consult and perhaps talk to several of you again, one to one, before we make up our minds on a course of action. I will let you Erebuses get back to your ship before our midday sunset. Godspeed, gentlemen. I shall see you all on Sunday."
The men filed out. FitzJames came around, leaned close, and whispered,
"I may want to borrow that Book of Leviathan from you, Francis,"
and followed his men forward to where they were struggling into their frozen slops. Terra's officers went back to their duties. Captain Crozier sat for a few minutes in his chair at the head of the table, thinking about what had been discussed. The fire for survival burned hotter than ever in his aching chest.
"Captain."
Crozier looked up. It was the old steward from Erebus, Bridgens, who had filled in on the serving because of both Captain Steward's illnesses. The man had been helping Gibson clean up the pewter plates and teacups.
You can go, Bridgens," said Crozier. "Go on with the others. Gibson will attend to all this. We don't want you walking back to Erebus on your own."
"Yes, sir," said the old subordinate officer steward. "But I wonder if I might have a word with you, Captain."
Crozier nodded. He did not invite the steward to sit down. He'd never felt comfortable around this old man, far too old for discovery service. If Crozier had been the one to make the decision 3 years earlier, Bridgens never would have been included on the roster, certainly not listed with an age of 26 to fool the Navy. But Sir John had been amused by having a steward aboard even older than himself, and that had been that.
"I couldn't help but hear the discussion, Captain Crozier. The three options of staying with the ships and hoping for a thaw, heading south to Fish River, or crossing the ice to Boothia. If the captain doesn't mind, I'd like to suggest a fourth option."
The captain did mind. Even an egalitarian Irishman like Francis Crozier bridled a bit at having a subordinate officer's steward give advice on life and death command problems. But he said,
"Go ahead."
The steward went to the wall of books set into the stern bulkhead and pulled two large volumes, bringing them over to the table and setting them down with a thud.
"I know you're aware, Captain, that in 1829, Sir John Ross and his nephew James sailed their ship Victory down the east coast of Boothia Felix, the peninsula they discovered, and which we now call Boothia Peninsula."
"I am very aware of this, Mr. Bridgens," Crozier said coldly. "I know Sir John and his nephew Sir James very well."
After 5 years in the ice of Antarctica with James Clark Ross, Crozier thought he was understating the acquaintance.
"Yes, sir,"
said Bridgens, nodding,
but not seeming abashed.
Then I'm sure you know the details of their expedition, Captain Crozier. They spent 4 winters in the ice. That first winter, Sir John anchored Victory in what he named Felix Harbour on the east coast of Boothia, almost due east of our position here.
Were you on this expedition, Mr. Bridgens? Asked Crozier, willing the old man to get on with it.
I did not have that honour, Captain, but I have read these 2 large volumes, written by Sir John, detailing his expedition. I wonder if you have had the time to do the same, sir?
Crozier felt his Irish anger building. This old steward's brashness was skirting on impertinence. I have looked at the books, of course, he said coolly. I have not had the time to read them carefully. Is there a point to this, Mr. Bridgens?
Any other officer, warrant officer, petty officer, seaman or marine under Crozier's command would have received the message and been backing out of the great cabin while bowing low by now. But Bridgens seemed oblivious of his expedition commander's irritation.
Yes, Captain, said the old man. The point is that John Ross...
Sir John, interrupted Crozier.
Of course. Sir John Ross had much the same problem we do now, Captain.
Nonsense. He and James and Victory were frozen in on the east side of Boothia, Bridgens, precisely where we'd like to sledge to if we have the time and wherewithal. 100s of miles east of here.
Yes, sir. But at the same latitude. Although Victory didn't have to face this god-cursed pack ice coming down from the northwest all the time, thanks to Boothia. But she spent 3 winters in the ice there, Captain. James Ross sledged more than 600 miles west across Boothia and the ice to King William Land, just 25 miles south-southeast of us, Captain. He named Victory Point, the same point and cairn site that poor Lieutenant Gore sledged to last summer before his unfortunate accident.
Do you think I don't know that Sir James discovered King William Land and named Victory Point? Demanded Crozier. His voice was taut with irritation. He also discovered the goddamned North Magnetic Pole during that expedition, Bridgens. Sir James was the most outstanding long-distance sledger of our era.
Yes, sir, said Bridgens.
His small steward's smile made Crozier want to strike him. The captain knew, had known before sailing, that this old man was a well-known sodomite, at least on shore. After the Calker mates near mutiny, Captain Crozier was sick of sodomites.
My point is, Captain Crozier, that after 3 winters in the ice, with his men as sick with scurvy as ours will be by this summer, Sir John decided that they would never get out of the ice and sank Victory in 10 fathoms of water there off the east coast of Boothia, due east of us. And they headed north to Fury Beach, where Captain Parry had left supplies and boats.
Crozier realized that he could hang this man, but he could not shut him up. He frowned and listened.
You remember, Captain, that Parry's supplies of food and boats were there at Fury Beach. Ross took the boats and sailed north along the coast to Cape Clarence, where from the cliffs there they could see north across Barrow Strait and Lancaster Sound to where they hoped to find whaling ships. But the sound was solid ice, sir. That summer was as bad as our last 2 summers have been, and as this coming one may be.
Crozier waited. For the first time since his deathly illness in January, he wished he had a glass of whiskey.
They went back to Fury Beach and spent a 4th winter there, Captain. Men were close to dying of scurvy. The next July, 1833, 4 years after they had entered the ice up there, they set out in the small boats north and then east down Lancaster Sound, past Admiral Inlet and Navy Board Inlet, when, on the morning of 25 August, James Ross, Sir James now, saw a sail. They waved, hallooed and fired rockets. The sail disappeared east over the horizon.
I remember Sir James mentioning something about that, Crozier said dryly.
Yes, Captain, I imagine he would, said Bridgens, with his maddening little pedant's smile. But the wind calmed, and the men rowed like Smoke and Oakham, sir, and they caught up to the whaler. She was the Isabella, Captain, the same ship that Sir John had commanded way back in 1818. Sir John and Sir James and the crew of Victory spent 4 years in the ice at our latitude, Captain, continued Bridgens, and only one man died, the carpenter, a Mr. Thomas, who had a dyspeptic and disagreeable disposition.
Your point? Asked Crozier again. His voice was very flat.
He was too aware that more than a dozen men had died under his command on this expedition. There are still boats and stores at Fury Beach, said Bridgens. And my guess is that any rescue party sent out for us last year or this coming summer will leave more boats and stores there. It's the first place the Admiralty will think of to leave caches for us and for future rescue parties. Sir John's survival assured that.
Crozier sighed. Are you in the habit of thinking like the Admiralty, subordinate officer's steward, Bridgens?
Sometimes, yes, said the old man. It's a habit of decades, Captain Crozier. After a while, proximity to fools forces one to think like a fool.
That will be all, Steward Bridgens, snapped Crozier.
Aye, sir. But read the 2 volumes, Captain. Sir John lays it all out. How to survive on the ice. How to fight the scurvy. How to find and use Eskimo natives to help in the hunting. How to build little houses out of blocks of snow.
That will be all, Steward.
Aye, sir.
Bridgens knuckled his forehead and turned toward the companionway, but not before sliding the 2 thick volumes closer to Crozier. The captain sat alone in the freezing great cabin for another 10 minutes. He listened to the Erebus's clatter up the main ladderway and stomp across the deck above. He heard shouts as terror officers on deck bid their comrades farewell and wished them a safe crossing of the ice. The ship quieted, except for the bustle of men settling down after their supper and grog forward. Crozier heard the tables ratcheted up in the crewman's berthing area. He heard his officers clump down the ladderway, hang their slops, and come aft for their own supper. They sounded more chipper than they had at breakfast. Crozier finally stood, stiff with cold and body aches, lifted the 2 heavy volumes, and carefully set them back in their place on the shelf, set into the aft bulkhead.
Chapter 31. Good Sir. Latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north, longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west, 6 March 1848. The surgeon woke to shouts and screaming. For a minute he did not know where he was, and then he remembered. Sir John's great cabin, now the sick bay on Erebus. It was the middle of the night. All the whale oil lamps had been extinguished, and the only light came through the open door to the companionway. Good Sir had fallen asleep on an extra cot. 7 men, seriously ill with scurvy, and 1 man with stones in his kidney were sleeping in the other cots. The man with stones had been dosed with opium. Good Sir had been dreaming that his men were screaming as they were dying. They were dying in his dream because he did not know how to save them. Trained as an anatomist, Good Sir was less skilled than the 3 dead expedition surgeons had been at a naval surgeon's primary responsibility, dispensing pills, potions, emetics, herbs, and boluses. Dr. Petty had once explained to Good Sir that the vast majority of the medicines were useless for the specific sailor's ailments. Most merely served to clean out the bowels and belly in an explosive manner. But the more powerful the purgative, the more effective the seaman thought the treatment was. It was the idea of medicinal help that helped the sailors heal. according to the late Peddy. In most cases not involving actual surgery, the body either healed itself or the patient died. Good sir had been dreaming that they were all dying, screaming as they died. But these screams were real. They seemed to be coming up through the deck. Henry Lloyd, good sir's assistant, ran into the sickbay with his shirt tails hanging out from under his sweaters. Lloyd was carrying a lantern, and good sir could see that he had no shoes on. He must have run straight from his hammock.
"What's going on?"
whispered good sir. The sick men had not been roused from sleep by the screams from below.
"The captain wants you forward by the main ladder,"
said Lloyd. He made no attempt to lower his voice. The young man sounded shrill and terrified.
"Shh,"
said good sir.
"What's happening, Henry?"
"The thing's inside, doctor,"
Lloyd cried through chattering teeth.
"It's below. It's killing men below."
"Watch the men here," ordered good sir. "Fetch me if any of them wakes or takes a turn for the worse. And go put your boots and outer layers on."
Good sir went forward through a milling of warrant officers and petty officers, coming out of their cubicles and struggling into their clothes. Captain Fitzjames was standing with Le Vicomte at the head of the hatchway open to the lower decks. The captain had a pistol in his hand.
"Sergeant, there have been men injured below. You'll come with us when we go down to fetch them. You'll need your slops."
Good sir nodded dumbly. First Mate DeVoe came down the ladder from the deck above. Cold air rolled down with him, taking good sir's breath away. For the past week, Erebus had been rocked and battered by a blizzard and staggeringly low temperatures, some reaching down to minus 100 degrees. The surgeon had not been able to spend his allotted time on Terra. There had been no communication between the ships while the blizzard raged. DeVoe brushed snow off his slops.
"The three men on watch haven't seen anything outside, Captain. I told them to stand by."
Fitzjames nodded.
"We need weapons, Charles."
"The three shotguns up on deck are all we've issued tonight," said DeVoe.
Another scream came up from the darkness below. Good sir could not tell if it came from the orlop deck or deeper, from the lower hold deck. Both hatches seemed to be open below.
"Lieutenant Le Vicomte," barked Fitzjames, "take three men down through the scuttle in the officer's mess to the spirit room, and hand up as many muskets and shotguns and bags of cartridges, powder, and shot as you can. I want every man on the lower deck here armed."
"Aye, sir."
Le Vicomte pointed to three seamen, and the four shoved their way aft through the darkness.
"Charles,"
Fitzjames said to First Mate DeVoe,
"light lanterns. We're going down. Collins, you're coming. Mr. Dunn, Mr. Brown, you're with us."
"Yes, sir,"
chorused the caulker and his mate. Henry Collins, the second master, said,
"Without guns, Captain. You want us to go down there without weapons."
"Bring your knife," said Fitzjames.
"I have this."
He held up the single-shot pistol.
"Stay behind me. Lieutenant Le Vicomte will follow us with an armed party and bring extra weapons. Sergeant, you stay by me as well."
Good sir nodded numbly. He'd been pulling on his slops, or someone's, and seemed to be having a child's difficulty in getting his left arm through the sleeve. Fitzjames, his hands bare and wearing only a tattered jacket over his shirt, took a lantern from DeVoe and plunged down the ladder. From somewhere below rose a series of terrible crashes, as if something was breaking timbers or bulkheads. There were no more screams. Good sir remembered the captain's command to stay by me and fumbled his way down the dark ladder after the two men, forgetting to take a lantern. He did not have his bag of medical instruments and bandages with him. Brown and Dunn clattered after him, with a cursing Collins bringing up the rear. The orlop deck was only 7 feet below the lower deck, but it seemed like another world. Good sir almost never came down here. Fitzjames and the first mate were standing away from the ladder, swinging their lanterns.
The surgeon realized that the temperature down here must be 40 degrees below that of the lower deck where they ate and slept, and the lower deck's average temperature these days was below freezing. The crashing had stopped. FitzJames ordered Collins to stop his cursing, and the six men stood in a silent circle around the hatch opening to the hold deck below them. Everyone except Goodsir had a lantern, and now extended it, although the small spheres of light seemed to penetrate only a few feet of the misted freezing air. The men's breath glowed in front of them like golden ornaments. The hurried footsteps banging on the lower deck above them seemed to Goodsir to be coming from miles away.
"Who was on duty down here tonight?" whispered FitzJames.
"Mr. Gregory and one stoker," replied Devo. "Cowie, I think. Or maybe it was Plater. And Carpenter Weeks and his mate Watson," hissed Collins in an urgent whisper. "They were working through the night to shore up that stove-in part of the hull in the starboard forward coal storage bin."
Something roared beneath them. The sound was 100 times louder and more bestial than any animal sound Goodsir had ever heard. Worse even than the roar from the ebony room at midnight during Carnival. The force of it echoed off every timber, iron brace and bulkhead on the orlop deck. Goodsir was sure that the men on watch 2 decks above in the howling night could hear it, as if the thing were on deck with them. His testicles tried to crawl back up into his body. The roar had come from down in the hold deck.
"Brown, Dunn, Collins," snapped FitzJames. "Go forward past the bread room and secure the forward hatch. DeVoe, Goodsir, come with me."
FitzJames stuck his pistol in his belt, held the lantern in his right hand, and clambered down the ladder into the blackness. Goodsir had to use all his will just to avoid pissing himself. DeVoe hurried down the ladder next, and only an overwhelming sense of shame at the thought of not following the other men, combined with the fear of being left alone in the dark, set the trembling surgeon into motion after the first mate. His arms, hands, and legs felt as insensate as if they were made of wood, but he knew it was fear, not the cold, that caused this. At the bottom of the ladder, in a black cold somehow more thick and terrible than the hostile outside Arctic had ever felt to Harry Goodsir, the captain and first mate were holding their lanterns out as far as they could reach. FitzJames had his pistol extended and fully cocked. DeVoe was holding a standard boat knife. The mate's hand was shaking. No one moved or breathed. Silence. The crashing, thudding, and screams had all stopped. Goodsir wanted to scream. He could feel the presence of something down on this dark, cold deck with them. Something huge and not human. It could be 12 feet away, just beyond the puny circles of the lantern glow. Along with the press of certainty that they were not alone, came a strong, copperish smell. Goodsir had smelled that many times before. Fresh blood.
"This way,"
whispered the captain, and led the way aft down the narrow starboard companionway, toward the boiler room. The oil lamp that always burned in there had been extinguished. The only glow that came through the open door was a dim, red and orange flickering from the few bits of coal burning in the boiler hearth.
"Mr. Gregory,"
called the captain. FitzJames's shout was loud enough and sudden enough that Goodsir again came close to wetting himself.
"Mr. Gregory,"
the captain called a second time. There was no answer. From their position in the corridor, the surgeon could see only a few square feet of the floor of the boiler room and some spilled coal. There was a smell in the air, as if someone was grilling beef. Goodsir found himself salivating, despite the sense of horror rising in him.
"Stay here,"
FitzJames said to DeVoe and Goodsir. The first mate was looking first forward and then astern, swinging his lantern in a circle, keeping his knife high, obviously straining to see down the dark corridor past the narrow circle of light. Goodsir could do nothing but stand there and bunch his freezing hands into fists. His mouth
filled with saliva at the almost forgotten smell of grilling meat, and his belly rumbled in spite of his fear. Fitzjames stepped around the doorframe and into the boiler room, out of sight. For an eternity of 5 to 10 seconds, there was no sound. Then the captain's soft voice literally echoed from the metal-walled room.
"Mr. Good, sir, come in here, please."
There were two human bodies in the room. One was recognizable as the engineer, John Gregory. He had been disemboweled. His body lay in the corner against the aft bulkhead, but grey strings and strands of his intestines had been thrown around the boiler room like party streamers. Good sir had to watch carefully where he stepped. The other body, a thick-set man in a dark blue sweater, lay on his stomach, with his arms by his sides, palms upward, his head and shoulders in the boiler's furnace.
"Help me pull him out," said Fitzjames.
The surgeon grabbed the man's left leg and his smouldering sweater. The captain took the other leg and right arm, and together they pulled the man back out of the flames.
The man's open mouth stuck against the lower flange of the furnace hearth's metal grate for a second, but then came free with a brittle snapping of teeth. Good sir rolled the corpse over while Fitzjames removed his jacket and beat out the flames rising from the dead man's face and hair. Harry Goodsir felt as if he were watching all this from a great distance. The professional part of his mind noticed with cool detachment that the furnace, as poorly banked as the low coal flames had been, had melted the man's eyes, burned away his nose and ears, and turned his face into the texture of an overbaked, bubbling raspberry flan.
"Do you recognize him, Mr. Goodsir?" asked Fitzjames.
"No. It's Tommy Plater," gasped Devo from where he stood just within the doorway. "I recognize him by the sweater and by the earring melted into his jaw where his ear used to be."
"God damn it, mate," snapped Fitzjames. "Stand guard out in the corridor."
"Aye, sir," said Devo and stepped out. Good sir heard the sound of retching from the companionway.
"I will need you to note,"
began the captain, speaking to good sir. There came a crashing, a tearing, and then a resounding thud from the direction of the bow, so loud that good sir was sure that the ship had broken in half. Fitzjames grabbed up his lantern and was out of the door in a second, leaving his smouldering jacket behind in the boiler room. Good sir and DeVoe followed him as they ran forward past scattered casks and smashed crates, and then squeezed between the black iron bulkheads that held what was left of Erebus's fresh water supply and the few remaining sacks of its coal. They passed a black opening to a coal bin, and good sir glanced to his right and saw a shirtless human arm protruding over the iron rim of the doorframe. He paused and bent to see who lay there, but the light had moved away as the captain and mate continued to run forward with the lanterns. Good sir was left in the absolute darkness with what was almost certainly another corpse. He stood and ran to catch up. More crashes. Shouts now from the deck above. A musket or pistol shot. Another shot. Screams. Several men screaming. Good sir, outside the bobbing circles of lantern light, came out of the narrow corridor into an open, dark area and ran headfirst into a thick oak post. He fell on his back into 8 inches of ice and sludgy meltwater. He couldn't focus his eyes. The lanterns above him were only swinging orange blurs as he struggled to stay conscious. And everything in that moment stank and tasted of sewage and coal dust and blood.
"The ladder's gone," cried Devo.
Sitting arse deep in vile slush, good sir could see better as the lanterns steadied. The forward ladderway, made of thick oak and easily able to support several large men hauling 100-pound sacks of coal up and down, had been smashed into splinters. Fragments hung from the open scuttle frame above. The screaming was coming from up on the orlop deck.
"Boost me up,"
cried Fitzjames, who had tucked his pistol into his belt and set down the lantern and was now reaching up trying to get a handhold on the splintered frame of the scuttle. He started pulling himself up. Devo bent to boost him. Flames suddenly exploded above and through the square opening. Fitzjames cursed and fell onto his back in the icy water, only a few yards from Goodsir.
It looked as if the entire forward scuttle and everything above it on the orlop deck was on fire.
Fire?
Thought good sir. Acrid smoke filled his nostrils.
There's nowhere to run.
It was 100 degrees below zero outside, and a blizzard was raging. If the ship burned now, they would all die.
The main ladderway,
said Fitzjames, and got to his feet, found the lantern, and began running aft. Devo followed. Good sir crawled on all fours through the ice and water, got to his feet, fell again, crawled, then ran after the receding lanterns. Something on the orlop deck roared. There came a rattle of muskets and the distinct blast of shotguns. Good sir wanted to stop in the coal bunker to see if the man belonging to the arm was dead or alive, or even attached to the outflung arm, but there was no light when he got there. He ran on in the dark, ricocheting off the iron, coal, and water bunker bulkheads. The lanterns were already disappearing up the ladderway to the orlop deck. Smoke billowed down. Good sir clambered upward, was kicked in the face by a boot belonging to the captain or mate, and then he was on the orlop deck. He couldn't breathe. He couldn't see. Lanterns bobbed around him, but the air was so thick with smoke that there was no illumination. Good sir's impulse was to find the ladderway up to the lower deck and keep climbing, then keep climbing again until he was outside into the clean air, but there were men shouting to his right, toward the bow, so he dropped to all fours. The air was breathable here. Just. Toward the bow was a bright orange glow, far too bright to be lanterns. Good sir crawled forward, found the port companionway to the left of the bread room, crawled farther. Ahead of him, somewhere in the smoke, men were beating at flames with blankets. The blankets were catching fire.
Get a bucket brigade,
shouted Fitzjames from somewhere up ahead of him in the smoke.
Get water down here.
There's no water, Captain,
shouted a voice so agitated that good sir could not recognize it.
Use the piss buckets.
The captain's voice cut like a blade through the smoke and shouting.
They're frozen,
shouted a voice that good sir did recognize. John Sullivan, captain of the maintop.
Use them anyway,
shouted Fitzjames.
And Snow, Sullivan, Sinclair, Reddington, Seeley, Pocock, Grater, get the men to form a bucket line from the deck down here to the orlop deck. Scoop up as much snow as you can. Throw it on the flames.
Fitzjames had to stop to cough violently. Good sir stood. Smoke swirled around him as if someone had opened a door or window. 1 second he could see 15 or 20 feet forward toward the carpenter's and bosun's storerooms, clearly see the flames licking the walls and timbers, and the next second he could not see 2 feet in front of him. Everyone was coughing, and good sir joined them. Men shoved against him in their rush to get up the ladderway, and good sir pressed himself to the bulkhead, wondering if he should go up to the lower deck. He was no use here. He remembered the bare arm flung out of the coal bunker below in the hold deck. The thought of going down there again made him want to vomit.
But the thing is on this deck.
As if to confirm that thought, 4 or 5 muskets, not 10 feet in front of the surgeon, fired at once. The explosions were deafening. Good sir flung his palms over his ears and fell to his knees, remembering how he had told the crew of Terror that scurvy victims could die from the mere sound of a musket shot. He knew that he had the early symptoms of scurvy.
Belay that firing,
shouted Fitzjames.
Hold off. There are men up there.
But Captain,
came the voice of Corporal Alexander Pearson, the highest ranking of the 4 surviving Erebus Royal Marines.
Hold off, I tell you.
Good sir could now see Lieutenant Le Vicomte and the Marines there, silhouetted against the flames. Le Vicomte standing, and the Marines each on one knee, reloading their muskets, as if they were in the midst of a battle. The surgeon thought that the walls, timbers, and loose casks and cartons towards the bow were all on fire. Sailors battered at the flames with blankets and rolls of canvas. Sparks flew everywhere. The burning silhouette of a man staggered out of the flames toward the Marines and clustered seamen.
Hold your fire,
shouted Fitzjames.
Hold your fire,
repeated Le Vicomte. The burning man collapsed into Fitzjames's arms.
Mr. Good Sir,
called the captain. John Downing, the quartermaster, ceased beating a blanket against the fire in the corridor and stamped out the flames emanating from the wounded man's smoldering clothes. Goodsir ran forward and took the weight of the collapsing man from Fitzjames. The right side of the man's face was almost gone. Not burned, but clawed away, the skin and eye hanging loose. And parallel marks ran down the right side of his chest, the claw marks cutting deep through the 8 layers of fabric and flesh. Blood soaked his waistcoat. The man's right arm was missing. Goodsir realized that he was holding Henry Foster Collins, the second master, whom Fitzjames earlier had ordered to go toward the bow with Brown and Dunn, the caulker and his mate, to secure the forward hatch.
"I need help getting him up to the surgery,"
gasped Goodsir. Collins was a big man, even without his arm, and his legs had finally given way. The surgeon was able to hold him upright only because he was braced against the bread room bulkhead.
"Downing!"
Fitzjames called to the silhouette of the tall quartermaster, who had returned to fighting flames with his burning blanket. Downing tossed the blanket away and ran back through the smoke. Without asking a question, the quartermaster hooked Collins's remaining arm over his own shoulder and said,
"After you, Mr. Goodsir."
Goodsir started up the ladderway, but a dozen men with buckets were trying to come down through the smoke.
"Make way!"
bellowed Goodsir.
"Wounded man coming up!"
The boots and knees pressed back. As Downing carried the now unconscious Collins up the almost vertical ladder, Goodsir came up onto the lower deck where they all lived. Seamen gathered around and stared back at him. The surgeon realized that he must look like a casualty himself. His hands and clothes and face were bloody from crashing into the post, and he knew that they were also black with soot.
"Aft to the sick bay,"
ordered Goodsir as Downing lifted the burned and mauled man in his arms. The quartermaster had to twist sideways to carry Collins down the narrow companionway. Behind Goodsir, 2 dozen men were handing buckets down the ladder from the deck, while others poured snow onto the steaming, hissing deckboards in the seamen's berthing area around the stove and forward scuttle. If the deck there caught fire, Goodsir knew, the ship was lost. Henry Lloyd came out of the sickbay, his face pale and eyes wide.
"Are my instruments laid out?"
demanded Goodsir.
"Yes, sir."
"Bonesaw?"
"Yes."
"Good."
Downing laid the unconscious Collins on the bare surgical table in the middle of the sickbay.
"Thank you, Mr. Downing," said Goodsir. "Would you be so kind as to get a seaman or two and help these other sick men to a bed in a cubicle somewhere? Any empty berth will do."
"Aye, doctor."
"Lloyd, get forward to Mr. Wall and tell the cook and his mate that we need as much hot water from the Fraser's stove as he can give us. But first, turn up those oil lamps. Then get back here. I'll need your hands and a lantern."
For the next hour, Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir was so busy that the sickbay could have caught fire and he would not have noticed, except to be glad for the extra light. He stripped Collins's upper body naked. The open wounds steamed in the freezing air, threw the first pan of hot water over them to cleanse them as best he could, not for hygiene, but to briefly clear away the blood in order to see how deep they were, decided that the claw wounds themselves were not immediately life-threatening, and went to work on the second master's shoulder, neck, and face. The arm had come off cleanly. It was as if a huge guillotine had severed Collins's arm with one drop. Used to industrial and shipboard accidents that mauled and twisted and tore flesh to shreds, Goodsir studied the wound with something like admiration, if not awe. Collins was bleeding to death, but the flames he'd been caught in had cauterized the gaping shoulder wound to some extent. It had saved his life, so far. Goodsir could see the shoulder bone, a glistening white knob, but there was no remaining arm bone that he had to cut away. With Lloyd shakily holding a lantern close and sometimes putting his finger where Goodsir ordered, often on a spurting artery, Goodsir deftly tied off the severed veins and arteries. He had always been good at this sort of thing. His fingers worked almost by themselves. Amazingly, there seemed to be little or no fabric or foreign material in the wound. This lowered the chance of fatal sepsis, although that was still a probability. Goodsir cleansed what he could see with the second and final pan of hot water brought aft by Downing. Then he cut away any loose shards of flesh and sutured where he could. Luckily, there were flaps of skin long enough that the surgeon could fold them back over the wound and sew them with broad stitches. Collins moaned and stirred. Goodsir worked as quickly as he could now, wanting to finish the worst of it before the man came fully awake. The right side of Collins's face hung down on his shoulder like a loosened carnival mask.
It reminded good sir of the many autopsies he had performed, cutting away the face and folding it up over the top of the skull like a tight, wet cloth. He had Lloyd pull the long flap of facial skin as far up and tight as he could. His assistant turned away to vomit on the deck, but then immediately returned, wiping his sticky fingers on his wool waistcoat, and good sir quickly stitched the loose part of Collins's face to a thick flap of skin and flesh just below the man's receding hairline. He could not save the second master's eye. He tried pressing it back into place, but the man's suborbital ridge had been shattered. Bone splinters were in the way. Good sir snapped off the splinters, but the eyeball itself was too damaged. He took shears out of Lloyd's shaking hands and cut away the retinal nerve, throwing the eye into the bucket already filled with bloody rags and shreds of Collins's flesh.
"Hold that lantern closer," ordered good sir. "Quit shaking."
Amazingly, there was some eyelid left. Good sir pulled it down as far as he could and deftly stitched it to a flap of loose skin below the eye. These stitches he made closer together, since they would have to serve for years, if Collins survived. Having done the best he could on the second master's face for the time being, good sir turned his attention to the burns and claw wounds. The burns were superficial. The claw wounds ran deep enough that good sir could see the always shocking whiteness of exposed ribs here and there. Directing Lloyd to apply salve to the burns with his left hand, while holding the lantern close with his right, good sir cleaned and closed the torn muscles and sewed the surface flesh and skin back in place where he could. Blood continued to flow from the shoulder wound and Collins's neck, but at a much reduced rate. If the flames had cauterized the flesh and veins enough, the second mate might have enough blood left in him to allow for his survival. Other men were being carried in, but they were suffering only from burns, some serious, but none life-threatening. And now that the most urgent part of his work on Collins was finished, good sir hung the lantern on the brass hook above the table and ordered Lloyd to help the others with salve, water, and dressings. He was just finishing with Collins, administering opium so the waking, screaming man would sleep, when he turned to find Captain Fitzjames standing next to him. The captain was as sooty and bloody as the surgeon.
"Will he live?" asked Fitzjames.
Good sir set down a scalpel and opened and then closed his bloody hands, as if to say, "Only God knows." Fitzjames nodded.
"The fire is contained," said the captain. "I thought you'd want to know."
Good sir nodded. He'd not thought about the fire at all in the past hour.
"Lloyd, Mr. Downing," he said, "would you be so kind as to carry Mr. Collins to that cot nearest the forward bulkhead? It's the warmest there."
"We lost all the carpenter's stores on the orlop deck," continued Fitzjames, "and many of our remaining food stores that were in crates near the forward scuttle and bow area, and a good part of the bread room stores as well. I'd say a third of our remaining supply of canned and casked food is gone, and we're sure there is damage on the hold deck, but we haven't been back down there yet."
"How did the fire begin?"
asked the surgeon.
"Collins, or one of his men, threw a lantern at the thing when it came up out of the scuttle at them," said the captain. "What happened to the thing?"
asked good sir. Suddenly he was so exhausted that he had to reach for the edge of the bloody surgical table to keep from falling.
"It must have gone out the way it came in," said Fitzjames. "Back down the forward scuttle and out somewhere down on the hold deck, unless it's waiting down there still. I have armed men at each of the scuttles. It's so cold and smoky down there on the orlop deck that we'll have to change the guard every half hour. Collins saw it best. That's why I came up, to see if I could talk to him. The others just saw the shape across the flames, eyes, teeth, claws, a white mass or black silhouette. Lieutenant Le Vicomte had the marines fire at it, but no one saw if it was hit. There is blood all forward of the burned-out carpenter's storeroom, but we don't know if any of it is from the beast. Can I speak to Collins?"
Good sir shook his head.
"I've just doused the second master with an opiate. He'll sleep for hours. I have no idea if he will ever awaken. The odds are against it."
Fitzjames nodded again. The captain looked as exhausted as the surgeon felt.
"What about Dunn and Brown?"
asked good sir.
"They went forward with Collins. Have you found them?"
"Yes," Fitzjames said dully.
"They're alive. They escaped to the starboard side of the bread room when the fire started,
and the thing went after poor Collins.
The captain took a breath.
The smoke below is dissipating, so I need to lead some men down to the hold to retrieve the bodies of Engineer Gregory and Stoker Tommy Plater.
Oh, my God, said good sir.
He told Fitzjames about the bare arm he'd seen protruding from the coal bunker.
I didn't see that, said the captain. I was so eager to get to the forward scuttle that I did not look down, just ahead.
I should have looked ahead, the surgeon said ruefully. I banged into a pillar or post.
Fitzjames smiled.
So I see. Physician, heal thyself. You have a deep laceration from your hairline to your brow and a blue swelling the size of Magnus Manson's fist.
Really?
Said good sir. He gingerly touched his forehead. His bloody fingers came away bloodier, even though he could feel the thick crust of dried blood and the huge contusion up there.
I'll sew it up with a mirror, or have Lloyd do it later, he said tiredly. I'm ready to go, Captain.
Go where, Mr. Good Sir?
Down to the hold,
said the surgeon, feeling his guts twist with nausea at the thought of it.
To see who's lying in the coal bunker. He might be alive.
Fitzjames looked him in the eye.
Our carpenter, Mr. Weeks, and his mate Watson are missing, Dr. Good Sir. They were working in a starboard coal bunker, shoring up a breach in the hull. But they must be dead.
Good sir had heard the doctor. Franklin and his commander had almost never called the surgeons that. Not even Stanley and Petty, the chief surgeons. They and good sir had almost always been the lower Mr. to Sir John and the aristocratic Fitzjames. But not this time.
We have to go down to sea, said good sir. I have to go down to sea. One or the other might still be alive.
The thing from the ice might be alive and waiting down there as well,
Fitzjames said softly.
No one saw or heard it leave.
Good sir nodded tiredly and lifted his medical bag.
May I have Mr. Downing to come with me?
He asked.
I may need someone to hold the lantern.
I'll come with you, Dr. Good sir, said Captain Fitzjames.
He held up an extra lamp that Downing had carried in.
Lead on, sir.